You're listening to Clinical Conversations. I'm your host, Joe Elia. Our first encounters with COVID-19 often focused on the lungs and respirators. Now that view has widened to take in things like kidney and coagulation disorders. One large study of kidney complications has recently been published in Kidney International, and we have one of its authors with us. Dr. Stephen Fishbane and his colleagues looked at the clinical outcomes in some 5,400 COVID-19 patients admitted to roughly a dozen hospitals in the Northwell Health System in metropolitan New York. Their report offers important clinical insights, which we'll talk about, but it will also be interesting to hear how the group coped with a sudden sharp demand for kidney replacement therapy. Dr. Fishbane is chief of nephrology at Northwell Health. He also serves as professor of medicine at Zucker School of Medicine at Hofstra Northwell. Welcome to Clinical Conversations, Dr. Fishbane.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
The Kidney International paper spans roughly 1 month's experience, March of this year, with COVID-19. Before we move on to your experience in preparing for it, would you very briefly tell us what you found clinically in your...
Right. So in this study, and to put it in perspective for you, so COVID-19 moved into New York with such an explosive rate in March in particular that, you know, it greatly overwhelmed the ability of the health systems, which just managed to get their way through. But for us, at the time of the writing of this article, it was based on the first 5,449 patients, which now we, as a health system, have treated 15,000 patients. But in the study, the primary findings, I think, which were important to us, was first being able to describe the number of patients who have COVID-19 admitted to hospitals. That's important to describe, is that 36.6% developed acute kidney injury. And people had been kind of waiting on that number, in that out of China and Italy, the numbers for acute kidney injury looked like they were lower. And anecdotally, we in the US were experiencing what we thought were higher numbers, and we were just waiting for a rigorous look at it. So yeah, I mean, it turned out that we found that a substantially higher number of patients were at least being reported in our study as being higher. That now has come out in some other work out of the United States. And then we had a number of other findings, I think, that were really interesting as well. But, you know, I think the first really important point was to remember, as you pointed out earlier, this is a respiratory illness. It is a remarkably focused, serious respiratory illness, but we are learning that it does affect other organs as well. So here it's the kidneys that are being demonstrated, as you pointed out, coagulopathic problems. Here it's the kidneys that are turning out to be an important secondary problem.
So the number of people with acute kidney injury were found to be roughly the same as yours in a paper being published later today in The Lancet from New York City, from Columbia. So same general catchment area, and your numbers are very similar. In reading the paper, and I want to focus on the paper a little bit more, 90%, roughly 90% of patients on mechanical ventilation developed acute kidney injury, as opposed to about 20% of those not on mechanical ventilation. And so, and the concordance or the concurrence of those things, of people going on mechanical ventilation and requiring or being recognized as having acute kidney injury, was pretty close, wasn't it?
Yeah, right. And so, you know, this is one of those areas in research that I find to be particularly interesting, in that, you know, think of it, we are at that point as this research is being conducted, we are so deeply involved with the intense care for these very sick patients So you would think that something like that, the concordance of respiratory failure and acute kidney injury, would be very self-evident and intuitive and obvious to us. And yet, although I think we might have been experiencing that clinically, it wasn't really until I remember one moment looking at the data where it suddenly occurred to me, this is really remarkable. There's two things happening. One is that there's a real concordance in terms of bad kidney injury right about the time that respiratory failure is occurring, and that for patients with COVID disease at home, kidney disease is probably not an issue at all. For people with COVID disease who are in the hospital but without respiratory failure, it's really not a very significant problem. But we found that bad kidney injury, severe kidney injury requiring dialysis, was really limited to patients who required mechanical ventilation. And, you know, that is important in terms of some of the inferences that one can draw based on that. So a long-winded answer to your question that, yes, very tied together, acute respiratory failure and kidney injury as well.
Well, you know, as I was reading your paper, I was thinking clinically, when somebody is evaluating a patient, if that patient is having trouble breathing, you're not looking at their kidneys. You're looking at the fact that this patient is apparently drowning, and you're trying to do something about it. But there were a lot of patients who were admitted to the hospital, but who are not part of your study. And the reason for the exclusion was that they had had fewer than 2 creatinine measurements, I think, during their hospitalization. So you didn't feel that it would be fair to evaluate them. And it made me think, the clinicians are focusing on keeping the patient breathing, and those kidney functions are being evaluated in the course of further clinical care. But I think what you're saying is clinicians should be keep an eye out on kidney function with COVID-19 patients.
Right. So that's clearly the case, that although we need to be laser focused on the care of the respiratory illness, because ultimately this is such a potent respiratory organism, but it does cause injury to other systems. We're seeing this unusual syndrome in children right now, but, you know, to a much greater extent, and not in the realm of rare conditions, but rather a very common injury that goes along with the respiratory disease is kidney disease. We understand that now. We understand that patients need to be monitored very carefully in terms of the development of kidney disease, and then the difficult decisions that go along with management. Do you use dialytic support, et cetera?
Let's move away from your findings regarding acute kidney injury, and let's talk about logistics a little bit. When did you realize that this kidney service might be overwhelmed, and how did you prepare for it?
So it was in mid-March that we saw that New York was quickly just having an explosion in infections. New York was essentially becoming what Wuhan was to China in terms of the rate of infection. And, you know, at that point, I think people understood the fact that there was a real risk of really overwhelming the health system. And if the virus has another surge in the fall, we've got to, again, be very careful with respect to that. But we recognized, I remember the moment when we realized that the rates were increasing so quickly that for the 10% of patients that have bad enough disease to require hospitalization, and then for the percentage of those that are going to have bad kidney disease with it, we really had to model out what this could look like. So as we got into April and May, if it took a relatively benign course, what it might look like. If it took a middle road course, and if it took a severe road, what it would look like in terms of potential resource needs. So we modeled it out. It did end up being the most severe possible course that it could have taken. And at that point, we did a lot of purchasing based on our worst scenarios, renting, purchasing, but getting the types of equipment that were going to be very important in terms of being able to provide dialysis services and the type of dialysis also that we do in the most critically ill patients, which is continuous renal replacement therapy or CRRT therapy, and making sure that our hospitals would have enough of that type of equipment. And we really strongly went with a mantra from the beginning here that we've got to be able to the greatest extent possible, try to cure the underlying respiratory infection. The respiratory infection, and we'll succeed in patients. We won't succeed in other patients, unfortunately, but that we never want the secondary problem of kidney disease to limit the patient's outcomes. We want to make sure that we have the resources that we need to be able to treat the kidney part of it. And yet, by the middle of April, I think everybody through New York was running on fumes and came very close to hitting that point of not being able to keep up with the kidney aspects of the disease.
Yes, and you had to move clinicians around the system too, didn't you, to have enough nephrologists where you needed them?
Right. So, I think a lot of health systems experienced this difficult and really painful issue in the New York area. I don't know if this occurred a lot outside of New York, but that there simply were not enough intensivists. There were not enough hospital medicine doctors. So think of it, this way. Our largest hospital out of 23 hospitals is North Shore University Hospitals, 865 patients, probably 4 intensive care units. And before you knew it, the whole hospital was basically an intensive care unit. I mean, units that had been classic medical surgical units were being converted into intensive care units. And there weren't enough intensivists to be able to care for these patients. So from specialties that were suddenly less busy, for example, gastroenterologists were not doing a lot of colonoscopies and other procedures. Orthopedic surgeons and other surgeons were not doing a lot of elective surgery. And so a lot of people were brought out of necessarily areas of comfort for them. Tom McGinn, who's the chairman of medicine and associate chief of staff for the health system, I think in a very touching way put forth the fact in March that a lot of us were going to have to get out of our comfort zones and get into areas of treating patients. And, it ended up, I think, for a lot of people that were redeployed into frontline care for intensive care and for hospital medicine care of less sick COVID patients, it ended up, I think, being a really energizing, I think in some ways exciting, but very sad labor that people were involved with. For nephrologists, it was a little bit different. Some of our people got redeployed, but because so much of our work exploded in the hospitals, that we were really redeploying our people from office into hospital care.
Did you have enough personal protective equipment, PPE so-called?
So I think that we were fortunate that for all aspects of protective equipment, there was enough. Now, as you probably know, by late March, I think everybody was worried about, would there be enough ventilators? Would there be enough masks? Would there be enough face guards? Would there be enough of everything? And, I think that New York State was very helpful in this regard. Our health system senior leadership worked very, very hard and long hours to try to make sure that the PPE was there. So many people, so many doctors were making a sacrifice, so many nurses making a sacrifice to be at the front lines here. And to be able to provide the PPE that was required was so important morally in terms of just how people felt about the work and the confidence. So it's such an important question. And, you know, I think the leadership in New York State, the senior leadership for this health system, and I think for most health systems in New York, really did a very good job of keeping us there. But we have to remember, you know, that if you let this pandemic explode out again in too large of a way, there's always that risk of running short on PPE. And, you know, I think we saw from some other countries how bad that can get.
If you could advise systems that will be facing a second wave, which we hope will not happen, what lessons did you learn from this wave that you're going to carry forward with you, even into the non-pandemic world?
Yeah, so I think there's a few lessons here that are important. You know, the first is that plan in advance to the greatest extent possible. Don't try to manage something that is just pulling you along, you know, the proverbial tiger by the tail. Try to stay ahead of it. Use data. I mean, we were at the point, at least on the renal side, of every single day understanding how many nurses did we have available, how many machines, the amount of disposables that are available. At the health system level, that means understanding the number of doctors, nurses that you have to be able to care for critically ill patients. And, you know, I would like to add, you know, a third part of it, not just that real-time awareness and management, but communication, because it, you know, did come at a time that physician burnout in the United States was already something of an issue, I think it's fair to say. And having, you know, that great physician leadership, which we have a lot of in our health system, to really keep the spirits up of people. And, you know, I think, you know, as we're getting late in the course of this, at least first wave, we had a call last night where we were talking, and there was really a lot of gratitude about the importance of just talking and providing support for not just physicians, of course, but nurses and everybody who's involved at the front lines of care to be successful. Now, if there should be a second wave, that's going to be hard, right? That will be, you ran on fumes and adrenaline the first time through. The second time through, it's going to take a tremendous amount of support. But we learned a lot the first time through, I think, to help everybody around the country.
If you could say something to the staff that went through these couple of months with you, what would you say?
You know, I just have learned and have developed such an incredible sense of gratitude for people that have left young children at home, babies at home, that have elderly parents that they're caring for, that have spouses with medical conditions, that have gone willingly to the front lines, and very few people that were not willing to do that, but just the amazing gratitude for the courage, for the fact that this re-enlivens in us the reasons that us as physicians, as nurses, as other healthcare providers went into healthcare in the first place. It's terrible that we've had to go through this for the patients most of all, of course, and their families. But, you know, I think a real awakening in all of us, and, you know, maybe it takes every once in a while a certain wake-up call about why this calling is so important. And I hope young people going into medicine understand that, Joe.
I wanted to ask you, Dr. Fishbane, what in your life prepared you for this challenge, do you think?
and maybe this is the best answer to your question, my training was during the AIDS epidemic. And I think that at that point in my career as a trainee, I didn't really appreciate, because this was the normal for me as a trainee. And yet, I think for me and for some of my contemporaries, that was very good preparation. But I think for everybody who has lived through challenges in their lives and they know they can get through it with courage and with, working together, as a team and feeling that camaraderie and collaboration of working together, it's so important, right? Mm.
I want to thank you so much, Dr. Stephen Fishbane, for sharing your experience with us.
Great. What a pleasure to speak to you. Thank you.
That was our 267th episode. The whole lot is searchable and available free at podcasts.jwatch.org. We come to you from the NEJM Group, and our executive producer is Kristen Kelly. I'm Joe Elia. Thanks for listening.